Recorded live in Petone, New Zealand, this is the Cinematica Podcast, your weekly guide to what's on at the movies. You can find this and other episodes of the show at cinematica.co.nz. Welcome everybody to Season 2, Episode 19 of Cinematica. I'm Dan Slevin, and here with me in the Cinematica studio is...
Hello, it's Simon here today.
And I should point out that we'll probably lose most of our audience at this point. All the Kaylee fans will
Our global audience
off.
Might stand down.
Kaylee's busy with other duties
today. Yep, she's away. We're sorting out some other stuff for me today.
So it's like a boys' afternoon.
How often? I mean, when was the last time?
It was just the two of us.
It's been a while.
Off the leash.
That's right. It's been crazy.
And today is actually, I did a little count, and this is the 50th episode that we've put together of Cinematica.
Isn't
a wild and crazy ride it's been.
And quite an achievement, really.
I think so.
Yeah. Early days, though, isn't it?
It is still. We're still learning.
Yeah, that's right.
And I'm sorry I didn't bake a cake. In today's episode, it's back to Bourne, this time with Jeremy Renner as the new Treadstone hero. Meryl Streep gets it on with Tommy Lee Jones in Hope Springs. Hirokazu Koreeda's I Wish is a little gem. And we talk to the directors of the New Zealand documentary How Far is Heaven. All that and more in this week's show. But first, let's have a look at what's in the mailbag. And this is the bit where I usually throw over across the table to Kaylee. She's not here, so I have to dig out my phone and look at some tweets.
Check out those tweets.
Yeah, we got lots of really good feedback from people about the interview with John Davies, the Academy Cinema, last week.
Okay, be interesting to hear that.
And it was really, there's some people very pleasant, inconsequential, interesting conversation with Academy Cinemas. At Academy Cinemas is John Davies' Twitter handle, re-giving the audience what they want, which is something he talked about, listening to requests from his audience and trying to find those films for them. David Larson, who's been a guest on the show, I wish Cinematica cast would do more long-form interviews. This week's with Academy Cinemas is essential listening for NZ film people. So thank you very much.
That's great.
The Murka, great interview with John Davies. Excellent insight into running an art house cinema in New Zealand. Kanda was refreshingly honest. So that's all excellent. Thank you very much for everybody's feedback there. We have a two-word review from Robert Cato for The Bourne Legacy, which we're going to talk about shortly. Still Bourne. It's actually... possibly one word, depending on your point of view. And some more excellent feedback for us. Pats on the back for our 50th birthday. The Wellington Film Society for the best cinema podcast in the land. Do check out Cinematica Cast and their weekly overview of what's happening on the NZ scene.
Oh, that's high praise. That's great. Thank
you. It's awesome. Thank you. Good. And we should return that by saying that if you're looking for a film society in Wellington, then the Wellington Film Society would be the one you'd choose.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Fantastic. Every Monday night at the Paramount Theatre.
John's situation, it's interesting because... you look at the history of that location, and it went from being, quite a standalone type location that specialised in art house. And
it was the only one
for a long time. I mean, John Hart had it and really pushed it that way, and then later on, Mark Croft had it, and they really specialised in playing films that weren't playing anywhere else. But it's kind of the times have changed, and there's so many more players now offering that content,
it means you've got to dig a bit deeper, haven't you, in terms of finding films. If you're going to, it's a bit like the Paramount here in Wellington now, that in order to maintain your market up against the big boys, you've got to dig a bit deeper. You've got to find things that aren't playing anywhere else, and there's which means that quite often you get quite obscure. There was a film that was playing there before the film festival called Cloudburst, which I really, really loved. But it was extremely difficult for them to market it. I think it was actually still being distributed by the Outtakes Festival. So it's a hard road for all those guys.
And especially when you think that often 80% of your box office quite often comes from the studios, it doesn't necessarily come from really, really small kind of releases. And so when you really
specialize, you can play them out, unless you can really...
Well, you can with those usually, but it's hard when I think there's that many more people playing that content, and digital, to a certain extent, changes that.
It does, because the idea of only having one print in town. Mm. If you get it, you own it.
That's right, and you work it, and you work it, and you work it. You know, and that's a really good way to do it. So now it's more about quite often if you're going to support a film, what's the deal? Mm. You know, so it's. Yeah, no, interesting.
And cinemas playing each other's off against each other with distributors, you know, mm. and saying, well, you know, if so and so gets this film, then I won't
it's
play
not
it.
Gone there. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Oh boy, it's tough.
The ultimate driver in all of that though should be how much will the film make? Like for an area, for a region, say Wellington, you know, how many prints or screens do you need for that film to make sure that it opens well but then hangs around, you know? And too often I think, you know, especially with digital, you saw lots and lots of screens with something, but it had a very short shelf life because it kind of wasn't big enough to sustain that size of release.
And I think that the key marketing factor in all of this and always has been with movies is word of mouth.
Mm, it's the biggest winner.
It is, exactly. And if you don't allow word of mouth to work its magic, you know, if you take a film off too early or if you cut back on screens too soon, then you're not necessarily doing the right thing by the film. But you sometimes have to have faith, don't you?
Oh, you do, and you get it, you work it, and you play a long game. But it's much harder to do that when there's lots of screens with it. So the relationship to the film is different. You know, it's fine if it's a King's Speech or something really big, and you know it's going to be big, and there's lots of, you know, I don't know, like all the mainstream things. But when it's a bit more specialised, it is a much harder thing to pick, I think.
Everybody wants a new Bill Cunningham, don't they?
Oh.
You know, which just played and played and played. And genuinely, that was a real word-of-mouth success because it came out of a festival, maybe got a bit of just a little bit of a push there.
Oh, I think
so. But it really was. It was about dinner party conversation and social media and people saying, what have you seen? You've got to go and see this film. Mm. And it really, it just kept on going for nearly a year, I think, that played.
I tell you what, one thing I'd love to get a bit of a response on from our listeners is how do they view TV ads for films? Like, how do they, I mean, often I see them and I go, wow, that was so quick. It really didn't, you know, often when you see some, I mean, if they're really, really big release films, you see quite long sort of TV spells. But if they're, you know, medium to small films, but they're actually doing a TV spot, how much notice does that person actually take of that short, sharp burst as opposed to still reading about it in the paper or reading about it online or going to the newspaper and choosing the Times? You know, what role does that actually play? I'm a bit sceptical, actually, that it doesn't hold a big piece of the puzzle.
Not having a television at home, I must admit that...
Why am I talking to you?
Well, I mean, I have a television. Yeah, obviously, yeah, I have a television, but it's for cinematic purposes.
Yes.
But I don't watch broadcast television anymore, so I didn't even know that movies were even advertised on TV anymore. I mean, I know that there were Super Bowl ads in America for the big blockbusters.
Still get the odd piece, but, you know, just how... Yeah, I often think if you can't encapsulate the film...
Yeah,
why do it? You know?
Well, and we were talking off air, but before we came to air about trailers and does a 2-minute trailer. How do you tell a story? How do you give people the right kind of flavor for a film? And how sometimes the angle that a marketing company or a distributor will take with a film isn't necessarily true to the finished film.
Completely, and it's the most crucial thing.
Yeah.
You know, if you get, it's all about momentum, and people come in, they see those trailers, and it sticks, and then they'll make plans to come back and see it. So if that trailer doesn't quite work, and yet you've got a jewel of a film, it makes it really hard. You've got to rely then on the word, getting people over the door, and the reviews that come out, and those sorts of things. But it all starts with the trailer, as far as I'm concerned. That's, and it's frustrating at times, because sometimes you know you've got this great film, and the trailer doesn't sort of live up to it.
One of my favourite stories about how kind of bizarre the movie business is, really, is the fact that they're called trailers, but they play before.
That's right.
Before the feature. And it's because back in the day, they actually did play after the main feature. Like you'd have your B feature, your newsreel, your cartoon, and then your A feature. And then the credits, in the old days, credits took about 10 seconds. You know, it was the end. And then they play, this is what's coming next week. So that's why they got called trailers, and the name has stuck. But it's just so, it's counterintuitive, like so much of this business is.
It is. I'll ask another question, though, of people out there. Would they rather actually see a trailer like they see now every day, or would they rather see just a snippet of the film, like a 2 to 3 minute piece that that really kind of, you know, a sharp, interesting sort of piece.
A scene that doesn't give too much away, gives you a much better sense of the pace of a film, maybe.
Exactly. And yeah. I see a lot of those when you go to conferences and stuff. You see these little short pieces, and I'm actually starting to lean towards that.
Just before we move on, we were talking about the Academy Cinema a little bit earlier on, and mm-hmm. John Davies, and how tough it is. The Australasian Cinema Conference is still going on the Gold Coast moment. You didn't go this year.
I didn't, no.
But I noticed
first time in 10 years I haven't gone to that.
Yeah. I went to a couple of them, and I remember some of what went on at conference. But the Bridgeway got the prize for the best New Zealand cinema.
Oh, okay.
It won that award, and I'm not sure whether you had to sort of pay to enter, or whether you actually had to make a formal entry, or what they were choosing from, because or what even the criteria was. But you know, regardless, we'll congratulate them because
that's a job well done for the guys up there. Mm. I suspect with that one, it's the people who supply the films.
Oh, yes.
Who make that decision. Even though I've been to other things where I think often it's a media type, mm-hmm. you know, survey through Facebook or whatever. Yeah. But I mean, I think, you know, that's how that was sort of judged and picked.
Right. Well, well done. Well done, Bridgeway.
Yeah, well
and,
done.
And I've been seeing a few tweets from industry people at the conference. They still get to see a couple of screenings a day. Each of the major distributors makes a presentation.
You see 2 to 3 films a day. Often they have something on at like 8:30, 9 o'clock at night, as well as the two during the day. And then you tend to see, you get presentations. There's awards given out before each, each distributor comes along, and they get, you know, what do they do with the box office and blah, blah, blah. So they get an award for those sorts of things, their achievements. And then they will, the marketing teams will get up and they'll talk about their campaigns on certain films. And then they'll roll off a whole lot of trailers of what's coming and things like that.
Mm.
And then
it's to juice everybody up, isn't it?
It's quite a buzz. I must admit, it's quite exciting. And then you get the feature, you know, you get the main event. I have to say, you know, it's quite tough sometimes trying to, you come out of it, you know, 4 days of films and trailers.
It's like
and
a festival, and it comes right on the end of the Wellington
Film
Festival.
Right.
So you've watched 3 films a day anyway,
and your head's kind of spinning at the end. You go, oh, what was that I watched again? Like, you know, but it all comes out in the wash. Something just, you're sitting at your desk one day, and something goes, oh, that film, that's right, I've got to check that out.
Yeah. And then, or you find yourself sitting watching one, and it's 10 minutes in before you remember that you've seen it already.
Right.
You saw it with a dirty hangover at Surfers.
That's right, Surfers.
And, but one year I was there in the days when there was real sort of budget thrown at these things. I don't know whether they still do it, but we were all sent away for lunch. We weren't allowed to hang around the cinema at lunch, and when we came back, they dressed the entire place, and there were a whole lot of actors abseiling down from the roof in black SWAT uniforms, and that was to promote the film SWAT with Colin Farrell.
And
that was an enormous effort. Smoke and
it always amazes me that, because when you actually see the final, the final product, you're.
Well, what a lot of effort you went to.
What SWAT anyway? You know, like, I was like, but anyway, they still do that sort of stuff, and it's a lot of fun. You know, I do like that stuff, and you know, that's
just reminds you you're in show business.
Exactly.
No, yeah, it's not all about the numbers.
Yeah, and good on them for doing it.
Yeah. So, talking of numbers, though, you've got the box office report for the weekend. How did the weekend go for New Zealand?
Okie dokie. Well, at number 5 this week, we have The Campaign. That's its second weekend release. Number 4, this is interesting. This Tiger has been. It's at number 4.
Bollywood.
Week. Bollywood.
That's a fantastic effort.
It
we
is.
Should maybe do a special, a
it
Bollywood
is.
Special at
I
some
think
point.
We need to get out there and see some Bollywood films.
Mm.
Number 3 is Step Up 4, Miami Heat.
Still that was, going.
Yeah,
that's 3 or 4 weeks.
Still in there. You're right. Week 3. Mm. The Dark Knight Rises is in number 2.
Holding so its own.
It's had a nudge. It's had a nudge from number 1.
And
that's 5 weeks in release, though, so that would have been, 4 weeks at number 1 with The Dark Knight. Mm. And then, drum roll, The Bourne Legacy, number 1, straight in there.
Yeah, right.
So, a good start for Bourne, Mr. Bourne.
Indeed. And talking of Bourne...
Jason Bourne was the tip of the iceberg.
It's Aaron Cross. We have never seen evaluations like this. He's Treadstone without the inconsistency.
I've never met anybody in the program.
So how many of us are there?
You ask too many questions.
Jason Bourne is in Manhattan.
Confirmed.
What?
That's all I have. Gotta go.
Gotta go. That's the Bourne Legacy.
Now, you've checked that out, haven't you?
So yes. Yes, yeah. I went to see that on Friday night amongst many excited Bourne goers. And I think, you know, it's a series that has genuine fans.
Oh, yeah. I love the Bourne films. And I mean, you know, Bourne for me is what, you know, pushed Bond, you know,
to raise its game.
The spirit of competition came through and everyone lifted their game. And I thought, well, Bourne, you know, to a certain extent, pushed Bond in that direction. And we're better off for it.
And yet, it's always had quite a torrid sort of life in terms of, you know, how those films have got made. Doug Liman made the very first one, and apparently that was a very torrid production process. He wasn't asked back for the second one.
But don't you have to suffer for your art?
Well, I think everybody suffered on that one, but it did make a whole packet of money, and so Paul Greengrass was asked to make the second one. He was only really famous for Bloody Sunday at the time,
right.
And a former documentary maker. So Paul Greengrass then made the second one, went off and made United 93.
Yeah, that's right.
Came back to make the third one. And then he, I think there was a tussle for power over the Bourne franchise with Tony Gilroy, who had written all of them. And who I notice is described as the sort of the narrative guru of the Bourne series. He had produced a script which Matt Damon wasn't all that happy with, and Tony Gilroy was but he was now so influential he was down to direct the next one. Matt Damon said, "Well, I'm not going to do another one unless Greengrass does it, because as far as I'm concerned, he's the man."
That was the reason
he asked for. Yeah, he asked for director approval, and the studio went, "Well, right. No, actually."
Really?
Because apparently Greengrass was quite difficult to deal with as well. So it's not as if it's a particularly happy franchise, you know, yeah, in terms of what's going on. Matt Damon has said that, you know, he's happy to come back when Greengrass does, and the studio not wanting to wait around.
Don't you find these kind of situations or dynamics quite staggering, given the sort of, you know, the size and scale of this franchise and the dollars involved? It's quite
that it's
quite
so
amazing.
Personal.
Yeah, that's right.
I know. It is. It is quite perplexing. And so the studio, it's Universal, I think, and have basically decided that they had to go ahead anyway. So they called Damon's bluff, basically, and said, "Well, we've promised Gilroy a shot at directing,"
which is kind of right in a sense, isn't it? Because I don't think any actor should actually get.
No man is bigger than the team.
That's right. That's right.
Except, you know, in this particular case, the absence of Damon, the absence of Jason Bourne, looms. Loves. There's a shadow over this particular film because even though they've replaced the function of Jason Bourne with Jeremy Renner as another of the hidden super soldiers, you get the feeling that everybody involved would rather Bourne was still kicking butt.
Big ask for Renner, I mean, in that
situation.
Yeah,
it's a big step.
Because I rate him. I think he's, you know, a really good actor, and he's done some good stuff.
The problem with the film is that it really it feels like a placeholder. It feels like it's just killing time until the real.
So how does it? Because I mean, I want to go and see it. I mean, I loved the other films. Mm-hmm. I really did. And so, how does it? I mean, I don't know much about it, I've got to say. So how does it kick on?
Okay, so what's happening is that if you imagine remember the last film, and Matt Damon is Jason Bourne, he's stuck it to the authorities in New York. He's finally reached the pinnacle. He knows exactly why he is the way he is. He escapes, and of course this throws the whole program into disarray. So it's sort of simultaneous with his attack on the sort of head office of the intelligence agencies in New York, and they realize that they have to shut the whole program down. Mm. And so
Brightstone, wasn't it?
Treadstone.
That's right.
And Bright Tread. And so Jeremy Renner, as one of these agents, manages to, like, they basically just kill all of the agents, right? They exercise extreme prejudice and off them all. Renner somehow escapes, and of course he doesn't know why they've tried to kill him. And he goes on a hunt to find out what the story is. So it's a very similar sort of plot to the Damon one. You know, what's been going on? What am I? What's my purpose here? Why have I been taking all these drugs? And who's in charge? And in the process, he meets Rachel Weisz, who's one of the scientists who has been developing the drugs that make them so superhuman. And because he thinks, this is, I guess, one of the interesting things about it, is that he thinks that without the drugs, he will lose his powers. And so that's really why he wants to find the source of all of this. He's not too fussed about the geopolitical intricacies of the whole thing. He just simply doesn't want to go back to being the puny and mentally puny soldier that he was when he was introduced to the program. So there's one sort of interesting sort of element.
It's a funny twist, though, isn't it? Because there's no reference to that in the earlier films. There's no, I mean, Bourne isn't dependent.
No, they've been making it up as they go along, yeah. I think. And you know, even Robert Ludlum, who wrote the novels, probably didn't imagine that they would be going in this direction. Mm. All of a sudden, it's like they sort of have to add new layers of story to explain what's been going on. It doesn't really make an enormous amount of sense. And it often is just an excuse for some action sequences in the Philippines in this case.
And it's a shame because, in a way, what you want is a passing of the sword, don't you? Like, you want a film with both of them in a way. So then you've got options franchising-wise.
And that's what they're... I think they've left too many options open for themselves. They've left an option for Damon to come back as Bourne, and they can just flick Renner on if they want. They've left an option for Damon to never come back and restart with Renner later on, or to team them up, you know? Mm. So it's almost as if the purpose of this film is to... not to work on its own terms, you know. Right. It's like it's there, you know, like those Marvel Avengers films. You know, we sort of knew that there was an underlying thread to all of them, which was going to be, we'll get them all together at some point in the future. And it was incredibly clever how they were sowing the seeds of the plot.
They intertwined that well.
They did, exactly. Whereas this seems to just be, frankly, pulled out of someone's ass.
Right.
You know, and it's the only purpose is to keep the franchise alive in the minds of the audience and to set it up for 3 or 4 years down the track when Damon's finally ready to come back. And so, on its own terms, it's sort of, it serves no purpose. It's utterly pointless, in fact.
So it doesn't have the fizz and intensity of the previous films.
No, and this is another problem in that, you know, we loved those films partly because Greengrass reinvented action cinema while he was doing it. And Gilroy...
This was the first time you saw those kind of chase jump scenes and fight scenes. And yeah. Fight scenes as you'd really kind of... I mean, they were still kind of okay, you know, unbelievable, but they were real. They felt the crunch.
Exactly. And there was... And Greengrass was famous for his sort of handheld shaky cam style.
Yeah.
I read an interview with him once where he said that actually his approach to shooting action was... based on his documentary background, he just tried to cause chaos and then shoot it.
Yeah,
you know, like he didn't try and choreograph it too much. Like there was that fantastic sequence in Waterloo Station in the last film, which was just brilliantly done and with lots of real people all around. And really, what he did, he just tried to treat it as if he was a documentary photographer shooting something real. And so, whereas Gilroy doesn't have the same command of action, he's a words guy, and so there's some quite wordy sequences where things have to get explained. We go backwards and forwards between Renner in the field and a huge bunch of fantastic, awesome American actors, including Ed Norton and people like that.
Oh, it's an amazing supporting cast.
But they're basically just sitting in a room about the size of this one with some big screens. You know how, you know, the situation room going, what's happening? He's just done such and such. How did that happen? I don't know. And then they go back
again. Get the so-and-so team on board.
Yeah. And it's like, oh, really? You know, so on that basis, it really doesn't work. And I sat there... And I was actually twiddling my thumbs, you know? Mm. I really was. I was fidgeting. I was looking around.
How was the crowd around you, though? How was the audience?
Everybody was disappointed. It felt to me like it was a very flat response on Friday night from it. And it was the first time I've been bored at a Bourne film. So my two-word review is The Bored Legacy. It was extremely disappointing. And to be honest...
When you grow up with these babies, you don't want to see that happen.
Yeah, I know. This is what happens when you leave the drunk uncle in charge and you go off and do something else. It feels to me... I said this in my review for the Capital Times. It sort of feels to me like Matt Damon's in the sin bin. He's had a yellow card, and he's sitting on one of those stationary bicycles, staying warm, right. You know, waiting for the interchange to be called back in, and that'll bring it to life again. To be honest, at the Embassy Theatre on Friday night, there was a lot more excitement around about Iron Sky. Right. Than there was about Bourne, and you know, I'm afraid that doesn't bode well for week two.
Week two. Well, we shall see. We shall see next week.
Indeed. Oh, breathless now after all of that.
Kay and Arnold, I'm so glad you're here.
Well, that makes one of us.
You two have come here to try to restore intimacy to your marriage.
This is insane. We're not 22 years old anymore.
I would like to assign you your first exercise. Tonight, I would like you to spend a period of time with your arms around one another.
I think we better stop.
I'm going to ask you to take a leap of faith and try something.
I'm looking for sex tips for a straight woman from a gay man.
It's most likely way out of your comfort zone.
I'm just not... That's not me.
And this is from the people that made The Devil Wears Prada. It's Meryl Streep, back in fully commercial movie territory. Yeah. Yep. And this is one where you've seen it and I haven't.
That's
so
right.
I'm going to interrogate you this time.
Interrogate me, that's fair enough. Yeah, look, I only saw this very recently. I saw it last night at a private screening, actually, with a crowd that was probably about 80% women and 20% men. Yeah, and it was a fundraiser. And I snuck in there and just sat on the side and watched it with them. And it's funny when you catch these films and you don't really, you know, I mean, I haven't really, the expectations aren't huge. I haven't done a lot of reading on it and all that sort of thing. And I just went in there a bit cold and it rolls along at a really nice pace. And it's good to see these two sort of actors playing off each other and they're of quality.
They're royalty, aren't they? They're American cinema royalty.
I mean, Steve Carell's in fine company, and he actually is also really good in it, even though he's got a secondary role. The star,
it's Tommy Lee Jones, isn't it? Tommy Lee Jones,
and the star of the film was actually Tommy Lee Jones. Like, he plays this gruff, set in his ways, husband who he gets up in the morning. I mean, it starts, you know, it's quite a bleak sort of picture. It starts with, the kids have moved out. They're in their, I wouldn't say twilight years, but they've moved on past the kids and now they're kind of into their routines. And so, you know, and she's this very sort of, what do you call it? Like someone, you know, she's very housebound and very house proud and all that sort of thing. And that's her role, so to speak. But she's unhappy. And it starts, you know, without going into too much detail, you know, they're leading these kind of separate lives, but they're still connecting. And she's very unhappy about it. He's kind of angry. And a lot of what comes across is, you know, his humor and his comments, you know, there's a lot of anger behind them. And yet, you know, very, very funny. The crowd that I was with were in, you know, they were laughing a lot throughout the film. It really worked well. And so, you know, she takes the plunge and says, right, we're going to go and get counseling. You know, we're going off to Hope Springs to get counselling, and that's where Steve Carell's character comes into it. He's the counsellor, and he's, you know, Tommy Lee Jones's character is just so opposed to this, but he budges and joins her, and off they go. And it just, it unearths layer by layer of their relationship and where they're at and how unhappy they are and why they're unhappy, and yet there's all these devices for comedy, and there's some, you know, there's all these great sort of things where they're sent off on projects, like Steve Carell will see them and then he'll send them off on a project to go and work out their intimacy issues and do things like this, and they're very, very funny, you know, and very clumsy and real, you know, like how real people would sort of do these things. And but, so it was very, you know, quite an enjoyable film.
But it has that core underneath it of sort of recognizable drama.
Absolutely, there is a drama here, and it raises its head. Not all the time, but at
just
the right
enough.
Points. Yeah,
yeah,
that's right. And you go from this comic situation to quite a, you know, quite a tough one or quite a sad one. And so I think, you know, it is a really interesting film because it's that question of what happens when you've paid the mortgage, the kids are gone, they're all sorted, and you've got this big old house and there's just the two of you. and you spend all that time and effort, you know, on other things, projects, whatever you want to call it, work, you know, kids and all these other things, and then there's the two of them left. And there is, I mean, there's historical things about their relationship which come out. But the whole way through, you know, these guys are really watchable. They're really funny at the right moments, and yet they know how to just flick it like that, and it gets really dramatic and serious for a moment. So I think you know, quite a nice film.
That's really encouraging, because I must admit that the trailer and the marketing campaign for it, it's definitely not aimed at me, I have to say. And so I'm going to see it this weekend, yeah, in order to review it for the paper next week. And it's one of those ones that I'm sort of, I've got a bit of trepidation about, you know, because it's like, oh, is this just going to be cringe making?
I think it definitely tests you in that department, but it's almost like it takes you to the edge and then it just doesn't jump, you know. Right. For me anyway, when I was watching it, I felt like it just took me to the edge of those things, because it's all about reestablishing, you know, their intimacy and their sex life. And so this is quite a hard, you know, like,
it's a tough thing to talk about.
It is, yeah, tough to talk about, and yet the way that it's done is quite realistic. And then the tasks that they're set to go off and reestablish their intimacy and their sex life is, you know, is really quite, you know, it takes you to the edge, but sometimes in a funny way, but sometimes not, you know.
I'm interested in that you say that Tommy Lee Jones is sort of really the star of the show.
He was for me, and I think it was just interesting that he seemed to get the really funny lines, like the ones that made everyone laugh out loud, and you know, but often that he was saying these awful things, but they were so comical and sort of, you know, awful that people sort of really found them very funny.
I read a good line about him in Men in Black, which said that, you know, he looked as if he was performing with a gun to his head.
Yeah.
In that one, does he look more engaged? Does he play more engaged in this particular film? He certainly seems to be quite a lot more relaxed.
I think he's playing, you know, a kind of, well, I mean, because he's an accountant, right? Well, you know, he does people's tax returns. He's very, I wouldn't say dour, but he's very, you know, black and white, mm-hmm, and straight up, and he's got his routine, and he, you know, he doesn't like change, and he's sort of, you know, at some point, you know, in the film, it's like, well, look, we got here, you know, what are you complaining about? You know, this is the routine that we worked so hard to get. Which is, you know, so you know, he makes that point at one stage of the film. But I thought, for me anyway, I mean, I really enjoyed watching him. He could say a lot with just an expression, you know, the tension on his face, the look, you know, he really was very watchable. Meryl Streep, you know, she's great, and but her role is different. You know, her role is more about, I wouldn't, you know, like someone who's just feeling trapped in this world, which is all about looking after him and looking after the house and looking after the kids and those sorts of things. And so her role doesn't sort of, you know, it definitely has funny moments in it, but for me, I mean, I just thought he got the sort of pillars, you know, that really stood out.
Right.
Interested to see if you think the same thing, you know, when, you know.
I shall report back next week. You have successfully managed to cure me of my trepidation about Hope Springs. Do you have two words?
I do. I think sassy seniors.
Brilliant.
Thank you.
Looking forward to it. Time for some news now. And it seems like every week in this section, what we do is we say someone's died, don't we? It seems to be frankly, I'm getting quite sick of it. But unfortunately, this week, the only real news is the sudden loss of director Tony Scott, who jumped off a bridge in Los Angeles on Monday. Nobody really knows what that was all about, and I'm sure even those who've read the notes don't really understand what was going on there. But speculation has been rife since then, and not much of it helpful. His films also weren't everyone's cup of tea. If you were a cinephile and a film festival goer, then chances are you may not have seen a Tony Scott film recently. But he's changed Hollywood in many ways. Those big action movies from the 80s through the 90s really transformed the Hollywood industry and the blockbuster. And you know, there were a lot of his films that didn't really do very much for me, and yet you know, last year, Unstoppable, the train, the runaway train film. Well, you know, I really enjoyed that. I think I sat in an empty cinema.
A nice train ride, wasn't it?
It was. And I tell you what, the thing about that film is that it was shot in a really interesting way. Like something that Tony Scott always held on to really was that he wanted to photograph real things happening rather than just throw lots of CGI at something. He had a visual aesthetic that he stuck to, and you know that a lot of and that it was developing. He was experimental in lots of ways. He wanted to shoot things in ways that didn't look like traditional Hollywood or television or any of that boring stuff. He was always wanting to sort of push the envelope a wee bit. Deja Vu in 2006 with Denzel Washington was like no other sort of action film at the time. And, you know, some of them didn't work. The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3 didn't work.
Obviously very close to Denzel. Because you know,
yeah,
a lot of films together.
Exactly. And I watched Crimson Tide not long ago. Mm. Rewatched Crimson Tide, and you know what a terrific film
that's good.
I'm a big fan of The Last Boy Scout as well.
you are. So am I. I thought that was. You know, I don't know why. It just, you know, it kind of. I mean, it's so silly in some respects.
and you know, regardless of how you might feel as a sort of.
I've got to ask though. Do we? Yep. You know, like because you think about Top Gun and the type of thing that happened there, and that whole. You know, that sort of era of films, I mean, the next thing that springs to mind for me is the Lethal Weapon films. And I think, and I look at those now and I just go, I cringe. They're so sort of, you know.
Yeah.
In some ways, it was a nasty time
blockbusters. It was. And I think that we need to recognize that, you know, when a director's starting out and has. And generates a reputation, and first of all, makes a whole a stack of money.
You've got to make pots of cash, give you options.
Yeah, Top Gun made a lot of money. Beverly Hills Cop 2 made a lot of money. Days of Thunder made a lot of money. And but it was only really around The Last Boy Scout that it felt to me like he was finding his own voice as a director, and starting to do things that reflected himself rather than maybe Bruckheimer and Simpson, the producers of those films. Mm. So, and I think one of the reasons why Tony Scott is compared unfavorably with his brother, Ridley, just in case anybody's not familiar with that, is that Ridley Scott's career started with major sort of art house credibility with The Duelists, and then he went on to make Alien and Blade Runner. And so the early part of his career was sort of blowing people away. But then Ridley Scott's, you know, until recently, his films had sort of got incredibly turgid and dull and very samey, and they weren't shot in a very interesting way. Whereas Tony Scott started with doing sort of what the industry expected him to do, you know, wrangle all of these big things, big set pieces and what have you. But as he got on, he got more experimental. And I watched Domino not long ago, and Domino's a weird film.
Mm-hmm.
And I just get the feeling that he was finding his voice at a time when Ridley Scott was sort of losing his. And unfortunately, Ridley Scott's reputation now rests on things like Alien and Blade Runner rather than that awful film where he sent Russell Crowe off to Tuscany to make wine or whatever. You know, I mean, that's a shocking film. And the Robin Hood one, you know, like...
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and yet we still think of Ridley Scott as this, oh, great director. And, you know... He's, apart from Prometheus had its flaws, whereas Tony Scott was doing some interesting things in interesting ways. And you know, you can only ask of a director that you look at it, you can watch a film and go, "Oh, right, that's one of his." And you could do that with a Tony Scott film. And, you know, nobody else was going to try and do that stuff. So I think, you know, there's a lot of entertainment there, a lot of pleasure for a lot of people, and you know. This very sad week for Hollywood, because you know what are we left with? That clown Anderson who makes the Resident Evil films, or you know, there's a lot of the guy who made the Van Helsing film. You know, there's a lot of rubbish out there in the blockbuster area. There's a lot of people doing not very interesting things, and you know, Michael Bay. You know, presumably he's going to make Transformers films the rest of his life. You know, is that really what we want? Whereas Tony Scott was going in interesting directions and doing things in an interesting way. So, that's my little essay.
Very good. Very good.
How Far Is Heaven is a new New Zealand documentary about the Sisters of Compassion who have lived in the remote village of Jerusalem on the Whanganui River for over 120 years. Filmmakers Miriam Smith and Christopher Pryor were here in Wellington for their screenings at the New Zealand Film Festival, and I caught up with them just before those screenings.
At a major level, they don't need us, but they do appreciate having us here. Does that make sense?
They actually asked the community whether there was a need for the sisters to remain here. But as years go on, you are our people.
It's cool here, because in town, well, you can't drive until you got your licence, but you can do that up here. And you can shoot guns around and the police won't hear it.
Lead us not to judgment, but to compassion.
And joining me here in the Cinematica studio is the creative forces, the directors behind How Far Is Heaven, the new New Zealand documentary. Christopher Pryor, Miriam Smith, welcome to Cinematica.
Thank you.
And congratulations on your film, How Far Is Heaven, which is unlike any recent New Zealand documentary, I think. Tell me a little bit about how the film came to be.
I'd been to Jerusalem initially, like when I think I was about 12 years old with my family, on a pilgrimage to Baxter's grave, and we'd met the sisters when we were there. And so I guess it had always lived on in my mind, and I'd visited a few times since. And it was just a place, it's such a unique relationship between the Sisters of Compassion and the local Māori community. The sisters had been there for 120 years since Suzanne O'Bear founded the order there, the sisters in Jerusalem. So it's the only order to ever be founded in New Zealand, and that it was founded in Jerusalem. And she always said, actually, never to forget that a Māori village was the cradle of our congregation. So just to have these this amazing bicultural relationship, we just knew it was something that simply had to be captured.
And also that it's very timely that something is made in Jerusalem now, because the sisters, the wider order, the average age is about 74. So they're perhaps a dying breed. And the three sisters that we filmed with in Jerusalem are no longer there.
Oh, really?
Being replaced by two others. But it's uncertain how long the sisters will be able to remain up the river. And the three sisters that we filmed with, they were the ones that had the long connections with the community.
Right. I went to Jerusalem a couple of years ago just for a visit on my way up to Ruapehu, actually, and thought we'd go the long way round and take a look. And it really was quite a remarkable afternoon that I spent there. It felt a little bit like a ghost town the day that I was there. And we went up to the church, and of course that was basically empty. And I didn't know anything about the sisters at that point, and I didn't realise that there were so few people looking after the place, and there'd been little notes left between them to remind them of tasks that needed doing. But there was almost no sign of the local Māori community either. it was, and because the environment is so lush and so green and so, you know, it's almost like another world. Like it could have been science fiction almost, you know, one of those, you know, you step out of the spaceship and you can't recognize the environment. How long were you there for the making of the film?
Originally asked Sister Sue for permission if they were open to a documentary, and that was in Christmas 2007. So we went, Chris and I first visited with Cameron's at Christmas 2008, and it wasn't, and then we made lots of little trips to get to know the sisters better and also start to get to know the local community. So it wasn't until 2009 that we started filming, the very end of 2009, we started filming proper. And we ended up living there for 12 months, but sort of spread over a year and a half. So we might say have 3 months there in one go, and then we're from Auckland, so we'd go home for a few weeks and then pop back for another. Yeah, so we were there, for 12 months of filming.
Right, and how long did it take before you felt like the local community, maybe not the sisters so much because you'd made those arrangements, but before the local community felt comfortable having you around?
Well, it, yeah, took a lot of time. And the sisters always said that. She said, you know, you have our permission to make a film on us, but you have to get your permission yourself, you know, directly from the community. And she said, and that will take time, and it did. I mean, I don't think we originally would have thought we would have ended up staying that long. It took, you know, it was a slow process, but very rewarding, like the lens of cups of tea and chat. So they have to get to know us as much as we have to get to know them. And so I think it was about 5 months of filming, just sort of lots of little stuff that people started to feel comfortable and be natural and things. Yeah,
there's so many aspects of the film that are fascinating. Whether it's the bicultural aspects of it, the what it's like to grow up as a kid in a tiny remote part of New Zealand, and some of them, you know, quite keen to get out as soon as they can, and some of them don't really know any different, don't want any different. That side of things is really fascinating. And then there's the clash of beliefs as well. You know, the sisters and the purity of their faith and the Māori community, the kids still believing in Tāne Whā's under the bridge. At what point did you become aware that that there were all of these layers to your film?
Oh, I think we were well aware of the side-by-side nature going in. I mean, Baxter actually talks a lot about that in his work, so I don't think that was surprising, but it was wonderful to see that in reality for ourselves firsthand, and to see how real the Tāne Whā is to the community and what that means. And personally, one of the interesting things that for me came out of that immersion was the recognition that, you know, within our Western or Christianized idea of spirituality, we see heaven as being outside of ourselves. It's being up there, like DJ said.
Something to aspire to, isn't it?
It's beyond us. Mm. And but with the Māori view is that it's of the earth, and we're of the earth, and it's, you know, the Tāne Whā lives in a hole under the bridge. It's very worldly. And obviously that has implications in terms of environmental matters and all that kind of stuff. So, but it's very much integrated into the world,
yeah,
the material world.
There's not much sign of parents in your film. Is that and I think you get the impression that that a lot of these kids are. You get hints of their home life, don't you, from the role playing that they do in school and from the conversations, but we don't get to see much of that home life. The impression is that they're left to run pretty free. Is that fair comment?
Well, I get they all have really full like home lives, and they've got lots of family. So under one roof, you've often got 3 to 4 generations. So they have a very rich life, you know, and everything is centered around the marae and stuff. I suppose our film, we did film, like, we got 300 hours of footage, so we did film sort of everything. But I guess at the end of the day, you had to pull it back to some main characters. And so the reason we journey with these kids is, you see DJ, who's one of the stars of the film, blossom through his connection with the sisters. And you see Chevy, who's another star of the film, sort of grow through a connection to her Māori spirituality and finding her voice. And so, yeah, you do kind of see them out on their own, because there is this wonderful freedom that they are able to roam and everything. But they also have, you know, heaps of whānau around them. Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, and it's the freedom that I remember having as a kid.
Yeah, well, exactly, and I think that's possibly what seems so unusual is that for modern day kids, that's not the life that they have anymore. Speaking as somebody who also played an innkeeper at about the same age in a school nativity play, I was a big fan of Damien, and he is an incredibly strong character. Tell me a little bit more about him.
He's just such a star, isn't he? He's really bright and, yeah, full of beans.
Yeah, and he's just one of those kids that finds it really hard to contain all that energy and sit still. But it's, yeah, he's so endearing. He's very clever.
Tell me a little bit about the sisters and what they think is going to happen to their community up there, because it's been such a major part of the community and the culture there for hundreds of years, not hundreds, but over 100 years. And if the sisters are aging, what do they plan for the future, or what are they thinking?
I don't know. I don't really know. I don't think anyone really knows what will happen.
Yeah.
I mean, spiritually, there will always be a part of the place there, but I think because the average age of the order, the Sisters of Compassion, is in their middle 70s now. So yeah, they are a aging order and possibly won't be around forever. So, but they're very philosophical. They will be of the mind that, you know, things have to die for new things to grow. And yeah, so they're certainly preparing and looking at ways, I think, to sort of continue into the future, even if they're not there. But I'm not sure what shape that will take.
There's a glimpse in the film of a photograph of James K. Baxter on the wall, and I know for a lot of New Zealanders, Baxter will be the only thing that they really know about Jerusalem. And I was thinking when I saw that photograph about what an even more bizarre community that must have been when there were sort of three spiritual elements to contend with. And is there much sort of hangover from the Baxter period in the community? It was quite a sort of a busy commune there for a while, but is there any sort of leftovers from that?
Only in so far, I think the main thing is that some people from the commune still do have a connection with people from the village, because some people stayed for more than a couple of years. So they might return or, you know, keep connections going. But yeah.
Yeah, otherwise you wouldn't really know it to see it from the surface. But Baxter's portrait is still up in the Wharepuni, so he's still revered and is often acknowledged. But yeah, he was there for 2 years. The commune was there a bit longer. The sisters have been there for 120, and the Māori community have been there for countless generations. So he was one episode, perhaps, you know,
in a remarkable
history.
Story.
Yeah.
And people still, it's actually wonderful that people still obviously make pilgrimages to his graves, and we met some great people that were doing that, and that almost sort of made it into our film. Actually, it's just, you know, we could only focus on the one story, but so it's great that that's alive, and the locals are very actually really welcoming of people that come up, you know, to visit the grave and things, and so that's really, yeah, they're very respectful of pilgrims to me. Yeah.
Yes. There might be a few DVD extras.
Yeah, I think so.
You've made an extremely cinematic film. It's beautiful to look at often, and I was interested watching it this could have been that you could have chosen to sort of follow a social realist sort of a gritty sort of I guess socially conscious documentary, but instead it has a sort of visual poetry and a visual magic about it. And was that one of the things that attracted you to the place and the story, was the potential visually?
Yeah, very much so. And the subject, and given its history and cultural significance, it just was clearly lended itself to a more metaphorical, poetic approach. So in terms of how we shot it, we didn't want to have the loose, you know, little handy cam roving everywhere. It was intended to be much more considered. And often it's documentary, so you never know what's going to happen, but we'd try and shoot the scene and cover the scene as we would with the same deliberation as we'd shoot a drama, perhaps. And in doing so, I think it suggests to the audience that there could be other levels of meaning to be read into this, you know, for its metaphor and the symbol.
And with 300 hours of footage to pare down to a roughly 90-minute feature, then there was a lot of scope in the editing, I presume, to help sort of create some of that poetry.
Yeah, that's right. And I think, well, because it's the observational style, we went in sort of knowing what we were making a film about, the relationship between the sisters and the local community, but we didn't know what that story would be. So, which is quite different, I think, to a sort of a tele-style documentary where it's based on interviews and you're trying to get, you know, more factual sort of a, you know, story out. And so we were simply just open, did lots of filming, and the approach with observational style is usually, you know, it's like drama, so it's very thematic and you're constructing the story in that way, which I think also goes well with the style that Chris shot it in. Yeah,
I just want to ask one more question about these kids and where the future lies for them, do you think, and how many of them are feeling like there's a future for them inside that community?
Well, I think that's really hard to say because they all are so very individual. DJ he's not in Jerusalem any longer. He's in another city. He's going to high school and he's just flourishing, which is really wonderful to see. Some of the kids are really keen to stay up there and, you know, perhaps make a life in farming or hunting, or, but who can say?
Because what is the economy of Jerusalem?
Well, they're all family houses, so they all have homes. So, and there is a little bit of farming on the river. There's a little bit of tourism work, and that sort of building on that, you know, some of the women have set up a catering business and things like that. So they're slowly sort of establishing their own employment, I suppose. But yeah, it is very limited. But they do have these wonderful, like, greenhouses. They grow lots of, you know, their own produce. There's heaps of hunting. So there's heap buckets of food. And actually, there's still the sisters, like 120 years ago, planted three original sisters, because Susanna Beer was French, so there's like walnut trees, chestnut trees, grapes, you know, all this stuff growing wild, which is amazing. So yeah, it's a pretty plentiful place.
Yeah, and we realised, you know, coming from the city, spending such a long time in this rural environment, how little you need in this world to be happy.
I guess that's true too, yeah.
And coming back to the city, it's like, gosh, look at all this stuff I don't actually need. So I think
I've got one more question before I let you go, and it's something that occurred to me before I'd seen the film, but when I saw the program note in the festival program. The film's called How Far Is Heaven, but there's no question mark on the end, and I was wondering what the thinking was behind that.
Partly aesthetic. I think it's open. It's neither a question nor a statement.
It is open ended, isn't it? Yeah. And I think that that's one of the things that's really lovely about your film. Thanks very much for coming by to Cinematica to talk to us, and good luck with your film as it travels around New Zealand. Chris and Miriam, the directors of How Far Is Heaven, thanks for being on Cinematica.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Christopher Pryor, Miriam Smith, and we've both seen this film, so probably we should spend a minute or two just giving it a bit of a review, I suppose.
For sure.
I'll throw to you, because I think people would have got most of my opinions through in the interview. How do you feel about it?
I think, you know, you got to take your hat off to this sort of film being made. I mean, you look at the credits here, and you know they've produced it, they've edited it, they've filmed it, they've pretty much done the lot, you know. So and over a period of time, and I think, you know, I can congratulate the Film Commission and all the support they've given. If I don't know to what extent, but I think this is what, you know, these sorts of films are what we should be producing a lot more of. Very well made, really kind of interesting little jewel about what's happening in our own country. And I think, you know, for the New Zealand Film Festival, hey, this is what it's all about too. You know, these and great to see them, you know, it got its place and its time at the festival, because I think you know, it's going to go on to a wider, a release elsewhere.
Yeah, I hope it gets picked up for international festivals.
Absolutely.
As well, because I think it is a side of New Zealand that even New Zealanders don't really know.
I found it fascinating. One, you know, the history to the place, and I thought that was really interesting, and the commitment that these sisters have made to the place, you know, and they were so graceful, these women, you know, they weren't dominating the landscape. They just kind of weaved themselves into what was going on within the community without disrupting it in any way,
and helping where they could, and just having little subtle influence, wasn't
it? Very subtle, yeah. And I just found that, you know, really Yeah, no, it's all about community and how you're involved in the community. They weren't actually pushing any type of agenda at all. It's just about how to make the place a better place. And their interaction with the kids is fascinating. I remember at one point watching it thinking, gee, you know, what are these kids? You know, they obviously have, I mean, there's a community, but they also have a fairly, you know, I'd say they're, you know, there's tough times that they go through as well. And what's the future? You know, and I thought, well, what's the future for the whole, you know, the sisters and the community? And it's interesting what they were saying in there about that, that, you know, it's optimistic. It is.
Yeah. It is optimistic. And I have to say that many of those kids in the film are so bright and so energetic and so positive that you'd think that, you know, the future's in good hands in some ways.
There's that great part in the film where one of the kids says, well, hey, look, you know, where else am I going to get to, like, drive a car at this age and ride horses and go hunting and whatever? And I was like, yeah, well, you know, kind of, you're right. You know, these are real amazing sort of life, you know, events that are really, you know, cool to do when you're quite young, and it does have that playground sense to it, interesting what you're saying, because it is beautiful to look at. It's so lush, yep. It's so green,
and the film does it absolutely wonderful justice.
They film it very, very well. I mean, I found it, like, one of the highlights of it for me was actually, and something that really surprised me was how the local Māori community, you know, the role of the Taniwha and their spiritual connections versus the Christian ones, and how actually, you know, really when it came down to it, I think the Māori spiritual sort of
the component
was stronger and entrenched, and they were more afraid of the Taniwha than they were of any other type of religious event and there's a point in the film where they're getting them to do the Christmas
the nativity play.
And they're all kind of like, it's kind of half-assed. The kids are kind of into it, but, you know, really? And you get the sense that they're distracted, and it's not really, it doesn't have the same level of meaning. And then just after that, they do the
Kapa Haka,
and they're on fire, you know, and they're into it. And I thought that was really, I mean, there was just these little things like that, quite subtle throughout the film, which were really interesting.
Yeah, there's a lot of richness there if you pay attention to it.
Oh, hell yeah. And I was really surprised at how important the spiritual side was to that community. I thought, you know, the Christian sort of, you know, they've been here all that time, that it would be a lot more entrenched. And in fact, it wasn't. It wasn't, you know, it was fascinating, I thought, how that relationship works.
Mm.
Yeah.
So we need to sum up. Do you have two words? Sort of the two words seems kind of belittling, doesn't it?
It does. I mean, I really encourage people to go out and see this. You know, if you didn't see it at festival, go and see it. It's a great, you know, it's a really good New Zealand film which deserves time in the sun. Mm. And I think, congratulations to everyone involved along all the steps of the way. I think, I was really chuffed to see it. And, I came up with a really lame kind of two words of just mighty compassion.
Mm. No, that's good. Mm. That's actually probably better than mine, which were just upriver.
Yeah.
Okay, we've got one more to go, and time is marching on, so let's
knock
go
it off.
Yeah, time to a quick trip to Japan.
Well, nothing French this week.
Nothing French. No, yep. Nothing to complain about. Yep. From a language point of view, I'm sure. That is I Wish, which is...
which I've heard lots of good stuff about.
Oh, look, I tell you what, it's a gem. It's an absolute gem. And this is an example of one of those films that is not playing in very many places. It's come back from the festival quite quickly.
I got a letter just the other day in the post from one of our regulars. He said, where is this film? You've got to start playing. So yeah, there's an undercurrent out there.
Yeah, I think there's a little bit of word of mouth burbling around for it. It's about two brothers who are separated when their parents divorce, and one parent goes north and one parent stays south, and they take a kid each, and they they live apart, and they talk on the phone a bit, and but they've got their own friends and their own communities, but they miss each other and they miss the family being together. And one of them, there's a new bullet train service that's being introduced across Japan, and this thing's going to go at like 250 kilometers an hour. And somebody says, well, you know, when the two trains cross, that'll be like a miracle. That'll be when magic happens. And one of these kids thinks that maybe if they could go to where the two trains are going to cross, they will be able to make a wish. And they would wish for their parents to get back together and the family to be reunited. And they gather a whole lot of their mates. They go on a train trip across the country to gather at this site where the two bullet trains will cross. And all of their friends have wishes that they're going to wish at the same time. And it's sweet, and it's about childhood, and it's about still believing in magic, and yet at the same time learning that, you know, not everything can get put back together again, that gets broken. And from a child's point of view, it absolutely honors childhood experience. It's not from the adult's point of view at all. In fact, often you get the impression that the adults are living in their own world that's going on a level that the kids don't know about and don't care about. It's terrific. It's a terrific film. Something close to a masterpiece, I reckon.
Wow, okay, so yep. It's got to be watched. Okay.
I wish.
And it should go a little bit wider then, by the sound of it.
Well, maybe it won't. Maybe it'll be a little bit. Well, if Bill Cunningham, and it'll just stick around for a while.
Look, I don't. You know, I love it when I get letters in about all the films, and I tell you what, I actually get them quite often. People write in. It's not emails. It's nice letters, and this one here is from Anna Thomas, and it's got this beautiful picture on it from the native flowers of New Zealand, Manuka Marlborough Daisy, NZ Mistletoe.
So some of our listeners have never actually received a letter.
I get these letters all the time, and this is one of the things. She says, please, can you get this film in? So we work quite hard on that, but I must admit, I love getting letters. It's great.
Well, maybe that's a little challenge for our audience next time around, is to write us a letter. If they actually, we always say at the end of the show, here's how you get in touch with us, but we don't have an actual address, do we?
We don't.
It's probably because we don't really like to say where we are.
No, that's very true, but I think, you know, let's write to us. I think that would be great. Yep. Write to us either via all these, we've got so many ways of writing now, but you can always send something to 52 Beach Street in Wellington. That's fine.
And it'll find Cinematica at 52 Beach Street, Petone, Wellington. Yep. It'll get to us, and we would like to open an envelope and pull a piece of paper out.
That'd be better than a handwritten letter.
And that is our show for this. Oh, I got two words for I wish I should get them out. Yep. It's just growing up, because it is. That's what it's all about, growing up, I wish. That's our show for this week. Next week, I'm going to be reporting from Telluride in Colorado.
Isn't that amazing?
I know. I'm so excited.
You just want to pinch yourself right now?
And I've worked out that next week we're also going to be reviewing, along with Total Recall, which opens this weekend, we're going to be reviewing Expendables 2, and I'm going to have to see. I've found out that the only way I can watch it is in a cinema in a little town in Colorado called I can't even remember what the town's called. Anyway, it's halfway between Denver and Telluride. I'm spending a night there on Monday night. I'll be watching Expendables 2 for you lucky people, so that we can review it next week. And the next show, it'll be 2 days before the festival opens, so I probably won't even know what the Telluride program will be, because they don't announce it until it starts. It's so exciting. And the next 4 weeks, I'll be on the road. So next week on the show, Total Recall, The Expendables 2, as well as Film Festival favourites.
How will we cope, Dan? It'll be interesting.
It's going to be an interesting technical challenge.
Well, you know, we'll just rock through it.
We will. We're pretty...
Might make some changes. You know, we'll see what we do.
but actually, I'm still the one that actually gets to finally edit the shows and put them up. So whatever you do, I can roll it back.
We shall see.
Also on the show, Bernie, Moonrise Kingdom. All that and more in next week's exciting episode of New Zealand's favourite movie podcast, Cinematica. We've talked about how to get in touch with us by mail, preferably next week. But if you insist on doing it electronically, Twitter at CinematicaCast, Facebook.com, Cinematica Podcast, or through our website, cinematica.co.nz. The show is a Guns of Steel production. The theme music is 6x6 by Earl Van Dyke. You can buy that at the iTunes store. And we're going to leave you with some more music. dug around looking for something from a Tony Scott film, and I have to say that having given his visual style the big thumbs up a little bit earlier on, he's got shocking taste in music. So it was very difficult finding anything.
There's plenty out of Top Gun. There's plenty.
It's all rubbish, I have to say. It's all FM radio rubbish. So this is actually from Domino, which has a bit more interesting of a soundtrack. This is Tom Waits and Cold, Cold Ground. Until next week, it's good night from me.
And it's good night from me. Go, go.